Andy and Jim. Yes, very pleased to be here and to be speaking to you. Can I just have a show of hands, please? How many of you had heard of Jan van Rensdijk before you walked in the room here tonight? Oh, actually, yeah, loyal following, thank you. Excellent. So not that many of you, which is really interesting. Lots of you will be familiar, because I know lots of you are involved with medicine, with his work, but won't necessarily realise that it's him, because when if you look at William Smellie, the man midwife, or William Hunter, very famous obstetrician's work, usually it's credited to them, and not the artist who rendered the drawings for them. And what we're going to look at tonight is essentially what was a three-way, a triangular partnership between these three men, which was not always happy, and but had this incredible influence on the birth of modern obstetrics. So, there is a book, there's only one book on Jan van Rensdijk and his work, and it was published in 1982 by a man called J.L. Thornton. You can find it online, it's a fascinating little tome, it's very, very thin, and this is his opening line: "The world knows nothing of its greatest men," which is a quote by Henry Taylor, and I think that that's very true in this case. So, the reason I became interested in Jan was because in 2010 I was blogging on the George in London blog, and I had blogged briefly about him, how I didn't know that much about him, but I thought that his work was absolutely fascinating. And such is the power of the internet that a Norwegian medical photographer, Øystein Hogmo, who photographs routinely across the board of all sort of medical problems and both life and death, contacted me, and he said that he had found his work online when he'd been researching William Hunter, and that he was truly moved by what he saw. And so we're emailing back and forwards, and you know, in my fantastic Norwegian, clearly. And he said that what do you know about him, and what is there to know? Because I want to know everything about this man. And he said that his camera, when he has the camera between him and the subject, no matter how desperate he feels for the subject that he's photographing, no matter how poignant, he said it doesn't matter because the camera will only record what's there. And he said for him, there is no other artist that he has seen that had to record something with his own hands that recorded it in the way that Jan van Rensdijk records it. He records what is actually there. And one of the things that we're going to touch on tonight is a very 18th century preoccupation, and one that must be very true in the medical practice now, is what is the truth? What is the truth of any subject? And that was a central concern of the Enlightenment, and it's certainly a central concern of these works. So, Rensdijk's life, as it turns out, he is the least known of the three, clearly, even though it's his work that we look at and consult. And it held just enough mystery to be fascinating. He had worked for both the great man midwives of the 18th century, William Smellie and William Hunter. And how many of you, incidentally, are familiar with Smellie and Hunter? I'd love to see, yeah, a lot more of you. And we'll talk about them. Van Rensdijk illustrated two of their defining works, a set of anatomical tables with explanations and an abridgment of the practice of midwifery of 1754, which was William Smellie's life's work. And William Hunter's legacy to the profession, two very different things there, was the anatomy of the human gravid uterus, exhibited in figures 20 years later. These books are still regarded as the moment modern obstetrics was born in Britain, through the labours of two supremely talented doctors. But Jan's contribution, apart from that little book of 1982, has been largely ignored. By now, curiosity had bitten me, of course, and I researched not only the Wellcome and the Hunterian, but also, after making contact with the Museum Boerhaave in Leiden, my husband and I made a snowclog trip there last spring in search of Jan van Rensdijk. And then, of course, Brandy and Jim got in touch with me after I had been blogging about this. The story of his life and his excellent work is a story about the coming together of science and art, tragedy and supreme ambition. But it's also about women and children and what it was like to live, work and die in Georgian England. But before we get to Jan, we must talk briefly about the two men who controlled his working life, and also the background to obstetric science in Britain at the time in which he was working. So first to the Chamberlains. I'm sure a lot of you have heard about the Chamberlains. For a century after they arrived in London in the 1560s as Huguenot exiles, The Chamberlain family of London-based man midwives had delivered women safely during difficult and obstructed births. Quite how they did this was shrouded in secrecy. A special carriage arrived outside the house of the already vulnerable patient. Two servants jumped down and loaded a large locked box covered in gilded carvings. The patient and their family were led to believe that this contained some massive and highly complicated machine. The patient was blindfolded and everyone else, apart from the Chamberlain family, were ordered from the room. From behind the closed door came the sounds of bells ringing and other sinister noises as the machine went to work. The frightened, blindfolded women later reported experiencing extraordinary violence at the hands of the Chamberlains. Yet many survived who would otherwise have perished. What was their secret, and what was the machine? The machine, of course, did not exist. Inside the locked box was another far smaller, and inside that, carefully wrapped, was an extensive set of well-made cast-iron forceps, at least five pairs. The blades were metal, fenestrated, and remarkably well-formed. At the earliest set that we have, quite astonishing in terms of the skill of the metalwork. Each had a cranial curve to fit around the baby's head. Crucially and very cleverly, each blade was separate, but could be fitted together through one blade possessing a metal pin and the other a hole, creating the scissor effect. If extra leverage were required, the two were lashed together at the junction with cords, which was then discarded later. Blindfolded, frightened in pain, and amidst the clatter of ringing bells and simulated mechanical noises, the women no doubt did feel extraordinary violence had been committed upon them. But the success of the Chamberlains could not be denied, and they had risen to the top of their profession, all the while keeping their secret. That's a reflection of the dissection theatre window in the currying of an embryo. The Chamberlain forceps. In 1668, Hugh Chamberlain was the last of the line, and he was childless and not poor, but not wealthy either. Travelled to France to demonstrate the forceps to the medical community of Paris. It seems he was hoping to sell their secret. And the man he most wanted to impress was François Morisseau, the leading obstetrician in the French capital. Morisseau was the prévôt of the Collegium of Paris Surgeons at the Saint-Cons. And was making rapid progress in identifying and assisting at problem births. He is most well remembered for his effective technique for delivering breached babies, and which I believe is still named after him now. Morisseau took an instant dislike to Chamberlain, disgusted that a family of doctors would withhold a method to save women for financial gain. But he was interested in the secret. Previously, births in which the child could not be corrected by manipulation usually ended with the fastening of metal hooks in the child's head to draw it out. Craniotomy, as it became known. This way, the mother might be saved, but the child must perish. Yet even the introduction of the hook was full of danger for the mother. If Chamberlain's secret method was successful, Morisseau knew it would be a pivotal development. He identified a patient for Chamberlain to demonstrate the secret on. Wasn't going to make it easy, though, was he? The mother was 38 and pregnant with her first child. Morisseau, when he wrote up the episode, described her as very small, très petite. She was, in fact, a dwarf. More dangerous still, she had grown up with rickets, which had deformed her pelvis beyond hope of safe delivery, and her pregnancy was a death sentence. She had already been in labour for 8 days. Chamberlain worked on the woman for hours behind closed doors, trying to use the forceps in vain. After another day of agony, 25 hours later, mother and child were dead. Hugh returned to London, the secret unsold and intact. With him, he brought a copy of Morisseau's most influential work, only published that year. On Hugh's return, he translated it as the diseases of women with child and in childbed, also as the best means of helping them in natural and unnatural labours. He added his own ideas and published it in 1672. Very rapidly, the idea of this book and before the Chamberlain's forceps got out. There was a great book upstairs by a man called William Gifford who helped disseminate his ideas. It was the first of England's new obstetric manuals, and later, in the form of a revised and improved edition, had a great effect upon a young man in Lanark, William Smellie. Now, the Lanark question. I'm sorry, we lost the formatting in PowerPoint here, but you'll get the idea. Quite why Lanark was such fertile territory for great obstetricians, we don't know, although Scotland is famous for producing many of the great men of the 18th century. It was a very fertile intellectual community up there at the time. There were almost 20 years between William Smelling and William Hunter. And Smelling was already working in the trade when he was an infant. And, of course, Smelling's job as a male midwife was very much about emergency call-outs at that stage. So he was getting there when, you know, a lot of time passed. And this formed very strongly his opinions on how to deal with childbirth. He was an interventionist, as Hunter would say later, and Hunter took the opposite stance. But they were dealing with 20 years when the use of forceps became common. William Smalley, as a young practitioner, was performing more craniotomies than he really wanted to do, and he found this very distressing. And he really did care about the welfare of women, whereas Hunter, on the other hand, cared about his legacy and sort of the good of mankind, but they were very, very different men. So it'll be up to you to judge them at the end. Smelling was very competent in pedalic version, which I'm sure you know about, but he wanted to work out how forceps were going to change his practice. So off he goes to Paris. And yet he came back with lots and lots of new learning, this forceps idea, but he was treating women with all kinds of gynecological conditions, and that's not something that William Hunter ever did. And two of his non-emergency work, William Smelling's non-emergency work, was broadly proactive throughout his career and included a cosmetic labioplasty in 1733 on a girl about to be married and concerned about her condition, and an imperforate hymen correction on a five-year-old girl in 1754. He was very much a working doctor of people. But one of the key things that I want to talk to you about tonight is to do with the broader picture as well. Two men set out for different reasons. William Smalley records for 20 years these very important cases that he, all the different cases that he works on. William Hunter sets out with an idea to be this great published doctor. But yet, what was going to be the audience for these books? Who would want them? Were they useful? Were they valuable? And we see a great change at the very beginning of when William Smalley begins to write in 1722. He begins to realise the value of his cases and write them up. Works on paper become exceptionally important in 18th century Britain. And part of this reason is to do with the truth, what is proving what's true on paper. And it was the introduction, believe it or not, of banknotes in 1725 by the Bank of England, where previously we had had very, very fakeable banknotes made out to personal people, private people, for the amount that they wanted to have. You see the top one, this is 1699. The one down here is actually quite a lot later, but it's very difficult to get decent images of them from the Bank of England. And they are completely standardised, and again, a Huguenot family called the Portals in Beer Mill in Hampshire found a hardware in paper that they could make, because they had a great water supply that they used for washing paper that was almost indestructible, and that they could watermark it. And they worked with the Bank of England to produce these almost unfakeable notes. I don't know if you know that in Britain, the post office had a great reputation for espionage at this stage. So John Gay, the playwright, was convinced that the dirty fellows in the post office do read my letters. So we were not sure about the value of paper and books at this stage. And with the Enlightenment coming, with the Republic of Letters coming, with these statements on paper, it's no longer bullion. This is worth what it's worth because someone in authority tells you that that's what it's worth. Right at the beginning of Smalley and Hunter's writing careers is an incredibly valuable thing. So, also, as an aside, our most famous master of the Royal Mint, Sir Isaac Newton, this exemplifies a problem with money and trust in England. When he was 19, he wrote a list of his sins at Whitsuntide, because that's the kind of thing that you had to do, and along with stealing, punching my sister, falling out with servants and having unclean thoughts, he had striven to cheat with a brass half crown. So he mended his ways very quickly. So This moment may seem like a moment unconnected with the new faith in print culture, but it mirrors increasingly supply and demand for the dissemination of true knowledge and the mechanisms such as the Republic of Letters. In the minds of the new intellectuals, including Smellie and Hunter, these changes spurred them on to produce true and valuable works which would take their knowledge out into the world, in direct contrast to the culture of personal status and secrecy of the Chamberlains. So, in 1740, William Smellie, aged 43, arrives in London with his wife. They never had any children. He had been to the capital the previous year, just for a short while, before his studies in Paris. So he sets up an apothecary shop in St. Albans Street, because it wasn't always easy for a male midwife to make their way, but it was still very much, and he wanted to work amongst the poor. The rich traditionally recruited men, the poor traditionally used the women in the local community. But William Smellie wanted to work in the community, and so he ran an apothecary shop in St. Albans Street, just off the Haymarket, in order to build up his practice. A year later, in 1741, he began to advertise and teach a revolutionary course in midwifery, changing the lives of poor women across London. Other midwives and male surgeons wrote pamphlets criticising him soundly, but William Smellie would not be deterred, and despite his lack of official appointments, his preference for delivering women in their homes, his success and reputation were growing fast. Throughout the following decade, he gave approximately 200 courses, each lasting a fortnight, and in that time he had over 900 pupils of both sexes, who delivered more than 1,100 women in London's West End. The patients were not charged on the condition that the students could attend. I'm not quite sure which is better of those two, to be honest. But at the end of the decade, William turned his attention to publishing. His health was uncertain, and he believed his legacy would be a manual from which men and women could learn the skills needed to deal with difficult births. In 1752, he published the first part of his A Treatise on the Theory and Practice of Midwifery, to huge acclaim, followed by a set of anatomical tables with explanations and an abridgment of the practice of midwifery in 1754. It was translated instantly into French, German and Dutch and catapulted its author into the limelight. William Hunter was also from Lanarkshire, as we've discussed, and he was born in 1718. You can see that he's quite a grand chap from this. He came to study midwifery with William Smellie, and stayed with Smellie and his wife, but quickly moved on to stay with the royal physician James Douglas, who was physician extraordinary to Queen Caroline, and he very quickly, he was already a higher social status than William Smellie, but he believed that he should kind of be at the top of the tree, and James Douglas was the man to reinforce this idea, and in that household he was exposed to lots of very progressive ideas, which he very quickly adopted. He was destined for great things. He was also incredibly ambitious, as was his brother John Hunter, but William had a little bit more charm. Smellie's hard work amongst the poor was not for William Hunter. In 1743 and 44, he studied surgery in Paris, just as William Smellie had done. And then he returned to London, and in 1746 set up an anatomy school, where gentlemen may have the opportunity of learning the art of dissecting during the whole winter season in the same manner as in Paris, which, when you say that, that means you'll be practicing upon real human corpses, which is also why it's only conducted in the winter. In 1748, he visited Leiden and was impressed by the anatomy work being conducted there. He became a man midwife for the Middlesex Hospital, which is a huge leap forward for the professional. He worked not only with women and corpses, but with live animals and dogs in particular. He wrote to a friend, "I am busy forming a plan for being an author. In short, my head is full of 1,000 things." One of these things was the anatomy of pregnancy and all that could go wrong. It wasn't about birth and delivery, it was about the problems of pregnancy, and particularly full-term women. Perhaps it was a mark of his success that he had to wait until 1750 for an opportunity to dissect a full-term gravid uterus. The man who drew it for him was Jan van Rimsdijk, the artist who was already working for William Smellie, and whose forensic chalk drawings were unsurpassed. It took until 1774 for Hunter's anatomy, the gravid uterus, to appear. It was a triumph, but both books had come at a terrible human cost. This is William Hunter's picture that he had commissioned. This is a medal by Birch to go along with the gravid uterus that he had commissioned, but in the National Portrait Gallery in London, And it shows him here in his working garb. And it's really interesting that Smellie was only ever pictured in his working turban and his working clothes. And Hunter adopts that method to publicise his book in 1774. So to Jan van Riemsdyk, because this is the story of three men. Jan is the artist who completes the macabre triangle, a big, raw-boned Dutchman. I think that he met William Hunter on the 1748 Leiden trip and was convinced to come to London, and I think he was already a forensic artist by then. So, previously, we have been unsure of where and when Jan was born, but I think thanks to the wonders of Genes Reunited, everyone building their amazing trees out there, the International Genealogical Index, and the Museum Boerhaave in Leiden, we have finally got a place and a date. Ochten Gelderland in the Netherlands in 1720. He came to Leiden, the 63 miles to Leiden, and married Maria Vandenberg in 1743. There is no Dutch death record for either of them, and it is a Maria who later features in Jan's will and then later dies after him. For certain, anyway, he was in Covent Garden by 1750 when he begins to work on the first 10 plates of Hunter's Gravidutris, a work that would keep him busy for the next two decades. Interestingly, the first 10 plates of the Gravidutris are all from the same subject. She was an incredible subject. The baby had been a very large baby, and it had become lodged behind the pubic bone, which is why the ear that you saw in the first image was so very bruised and swollen when they took away the uterus. By 1752, van Riemsdyk had also completed 22 of William Smellie's tables. There is no doubt that he had a forensic eye. He attended corpses as they were brought into Hunter's Anatomy School and Smellie's more modest premises. He waited as they were opened and the veins injected with preservative. The cause of death had to be established and examined. Once he waited, as an alternative baby more suited to the illustration was placed within the womb. He found this very, very difficult, as did the student who was observing. Then he took up his favourite red chalk, which apparently is still called 18th century red chalk when you buy it, and very fine, large-scale paper, and he sat with these women and their children for many hours recording the causes of their deaths. He was acknowledged, even in his lifetime, as the foremost in his field. He was exceptional. Measured against modern photorealism, he was almost as certainly the finest artist working in London during his lifetime. He also probably had the strongest stomach, and the work did not leave him unscathed. Nearby, the St. Martin's Lane Academy taught anatomy drawing to gentlemen, literally a stone's throw away. I mean, he would have walked past this every day. William Hunter... Oh, we're out of order, but never mind. Find it. William Hunter was... taught anatomy there from 1751, and Riemsdyk was already in his employ. The St. Martin's Lane Academy is the kernel from which the Royal Academy springs, and it must have been very, very difficult for Jan to be working in these circumstances, be so incredibly talented, yet socially to be totally alienated from the art movement that was going on just a short distance away from him. There is, as you'll see upstairs, an enormous difference between the drawings that Jan executed for William Smellie and the drawings he did for William Hunter. The Smellie drawings are quite gentle and soft, and even though the subjects are pretty horrific, you get a real feeling of kind of empathy with the subject. The Hunter drawings are comparable to modern photorealism, and the engravings, if you see the original drawings, they are actually very bloody and strong stuff, which is one of the reasons I realise that lots of you are involved with the medical profession, but some of them are really very strong. And the engravings that come afterwards that feature in the Gravidutris, some of them are cleaned up, but some of them are still very explicit. And we've discussed this quite extensively, and we think that this is almost entirely Jan responding to the will of the commissioner. So the empathy that Smellie feels for his subjects, and that probably I think Jan as a husband and a father felt, is quite absent from the Hunter drawings. And that's very interesting, and I hope that that's something you really take away from upstairs. So One of the key things that happens, lots of you may have heard that Hunter and Smalley kind of got rid of their, they saw these pregnant women, these poor pregnant women, and, you know, quite nefarious acts in order to secure bodies. It's extremely unlikely. Hunter details quite specifically where he gets bodies from, but there was the Mackenzie incident of 1754, when Colin Mackenzie was an assistant to William Smalley and her, William Hunter, and heard a woman deceased at full term. And there was no one around to help him. So he retrieves the body and he takes it back to Great Wimmer Street, to Hunter's premises. And he opens the body and he begins to anatomise it and brings in the artists. And both Smalley and Hunter attend to see, and John Hunter, who's William's brother, who did a lot of work on animals, is already there, and both men are really aghast at what's happened. They don't say it publicly, clearly, but Mackenzie is then, what he's probably their gifted student, most gifted student, and he is alienated almost entirely. He goes on to be successful, but they had to be beyond reproach, and it's also, that is a big break from that moment on between Smalley and Hunter. One was almost a father figure in terms of scientific belief to the other, and they start to go their own separate ways. And after that, Hunter becomes more critical in his lectures of his of this man midwife. So, Rimsick was there. But it was that he observed these rivalries and he became more and more torn between the two men. It's very difficult. And at the time, he had desperately wanted, he had come to London with this idea that he would make his fortune as a portrait painter. And the really sad thing is that none of the extant images that we have of him, of any of these women, have heads. So, in 1758, Jan disappears, unable to bear the atmosphere of the dissecting rooms indefinitely. He did not get far, but to All Saints Lane in Bristol. We're going to have to go back. There we go. That's where he lived, in All Saints Lane, Bristol, where he hoped to escape the medical trade and fulfil his dreams of being a portrait painter. He did paint a few portraits. We don't have them now. There is one, we think, still extant, but we're not sure. He also painted theatre scenery, pub signs, and drank, wearing the cast-off clothes of the doctors he had worked for. Maria had had a son in 1754, the year of the Mackenzie incident, Andreas. They remained back in London, whilst he caroused with men in the Ship Public House, which is now painted a lovely, gaudy blue, where Richard Smith, a local historian, commented that he was a very clever artist, but so miserably poor that he was glad to wear the cast-off clothes of surgeons. Which I think indicates that he hadn't really got away from his occupation entirely. He was also being hauled back to work for William Hunter, hauled back by carriage, to work for William Hunter on occasion, but he scratched a living painting signs, including the Bacchus astride a tongue for a pub in Cart Lane, which was much admired at the time. It survived until the 1930s, which is really sad that we don't have it. He was tall, raw-boned, and excessively proud. He was also lazy and generally in need of money. This need of money is likely to have been what led him to Jamaica for a year. How do we know he was in Jamaica? He disappears completely and his name goes off the rent books. And later on, he illustrates a set of blossoms from Jamaica. And regarding hummingbirds, and his footnote reads, after a great drought in Jamaica, the blossoms being shut and covered with dust, it had not rained for some time, a gentle shower came at last in the evening. There was a tree in my garden full of blossoms facing my back parlour, which was covered and hovered over immediately with a multitude of half-starved different species of hummingbirds, as many as there were blossoms sucking their food. Well, he certainly didn't see those hummingbirds in either All Saints Lane or Covent Garden, or Leiden. So I think that we are fairly sure that he, for some reason, it may also have been to do with the ergogenesis of the British Museum and Hans Sloane, who had returned from Jamaica and was very prominent in the artistic community. So they may have met that way. In 1755, whilst Jan was still in limbo, either returning to Bristol or still in Jamaica, Smalley returned home to Lanark, His work with Jan was done, and his health for so long against him continued to fail. John Harry, a former pupil, was appointed to continue his work in the field, attending London's poor women. Over the next 4 years, Smellie continued to work on the completion of his treatise, sending it to Tobias Smollett for literary polish. He died in 1763, leaving his books and effects to the school at Lanark, and a monumental legacy to modern obstetrics. The final volume of the treatise, number 3, was published posthumously in 1764. That same year, Jan appears back in London. It might not have been a coincidence, working on more illustrations for Hunter's Gravid Uterus. Back with women whose stories are known to us now through the notes taken by medical students who watched as their lives ebbed away, or as they died suddenly of a stroke or a seizure. When the Royal Academy, back to this one, was established in 1768, Hunter was appointed Professor of Anatomy, whilst Jan remained next door, still an employee. His growing bitterness was understandable. Hunter, this is sadly quite a small image, Hunter is a man directly below the chandelier. And if you can see, there is a man, I'll shout,
here, being posed by Moser, the artist, according to Hunter's direction. And here, there is another live artist stripping off his stocking, ready to get naked, and he's looking out at it. It's a fantastic image.
And so, throughout the entire time, the 1760s, a time when Jan was probably his most vulnerable, Hunter's style was on the rise and was absolutely ruthless in exploiting this. He had cultivated royal connections after attending Queen Charlotte's pregnancy in 1761 and was her physician extraordinary from the following year. That same year, his account at Drummond's Bank showed £28,148.13. He'd done very well for himself. He was determined to immortalise his legacy and even offered to build a public anatomy school at his own cost. The government refused to give him permission, imagining the public would never wear it. Hunter withdrew the offer, licking his wounds. He was a very proud and careful man. He was at the time, he used to say he's a wonderful man, and he's very good because he doesn't have a second home. His brother John said he was, in the strictest sense, a miser. More kindly, others remembered, though he lived surrounded by a magnificent library and a fine collection of pictures, well, if soberly dressed, maintaining a carriage, his general style of living was very modest. In 1767, he had his great Windmill Street Anatomy School designed and built, and lived on site from 1768. The great Windmill Street Anatomy School is quite extraordinary in the history of Covent Garden itself. Covent Garden is our theatre district, as I'm sure you all know, but Covent Garden Piazza itself is viewed as a theatre, and also St Paul's Church, which stands at the end, is a theatre now for street performers. The first Punch and Judy show was exhibited there in 1662 by Michael Pietro Gimond in a tiny miniature theatre. And it was also, they had a whipping post in the shape of a theatre, so even public justice was in a theatre. And the Bow Street Runners, Bow Street Magistrates Court, the Fieldings, I'm sure lots of you have heard of, they built at the same time, very slightly earlier, they built their courtroom as a theatre where people could come and watch public justice play out. And that's a very, very strong idea at Covent Garden. And Hunter was just carrying that on with the building of this anatomy school. In his mind, this would be a theatre for public education and dissemination of knowledge. He had accrued vast collections of minerals and animal specimens from all over the world. So quite a few of them were actually fake, but they've been weeded out now. He purchased a small picture collection, and he amassed over 10,000 books. These now form the Hunterian Museum. Work continued on the Gravid Uterus. Rimsdick was living with his son Andreas, known as Andrew to most, in Wych Street in Drury Lane, and also his wife was still with him, and he had a smaller son, also young. But the work was almost done, and as the 1770s dawned, Rimsdick knew that the job that had kept him busy for 2 decades was almost over. He had also been working for William's brother John on natural history subjects, teeth and gunshot wounds. Many of these sketches remain in the Hunterian folios, but sadly, many were also lost in the air raid of 1941. I think we've lost almost all of the early gunshot work, and well, we know we have, which is really sad. He was also working for the elusive anatomist Charles Nicholas Genty. This is quite a dark image, for which I'm sorry, but it's very difficult to get it at high resolution and pale. We think that Genty was a gentil, a Frenchman, who was living in London in the 1750s and 60s. He certainly wasn't English, and at one stage he does return say about his native France. He published most extensively in 1757 when Jan produced the Mexitins for the demonstrations of a pregnant uterus of a woman at her full term in six tables as large as nature, done from pictures painted after dissections by Mr. Rinsdijk. Mexitin is a really hard medium to work, but a very skilled artist. And Jan was a brilliant artist. He was also a very skilled engraver. But he was really good at Mexitin, which Prince Rupert of the Rhine first introduced to Britain. But he was very conscious of the fact that he was being outmoded by new engraving techniques, particularly in life engraving techniques. And as he said when later on in his work, he said there's no point trying to teach an old dog new tricks. So, but he was incredibly skilled with Mexitin. And people asked Genty why he had used Mexitin in this book. And he said, if I should be asked why in these plates, I chose Mezzotinto instead of engraving. I answer that this. This method is softer and capable of exhibiting a nearer imitation of nature than the engraving itself, however well so performed. And this again comes back to this idea of truth and what is actually in front of us. And Hunter was also commended at the time for making Rimstick work with the women, not from nature or imagination. So we're seeing this again playing out. In 1762, the famous Quaker Dr. John Fothergill sent to James Pemberton of Philadelphia an early teaching collection. Seven packing cases duly arrived, containing three gypsum casts, a skeleton of an adult woman and a fetus, and 18 drawings, 16 of which were by Jan. So his work is in America in 1762. Hunter, in 1768, says of his new house that he's installing a printing press there, which again is a even further towards this pursuit of these manuals of what is going to be disseminated. The engravings are now finished. Only the letters of reference and the inscriptions at the bottom of the plates will be put in. It will make a very considerable work for the expense and show. Perhaps it will be the most considerable in a way that has ever been published, and ever will be published. So few men can have had the same opportunities, or better, than I have had. In 1772, Jan draws his final drawing for Hunter, and apart from the first 10 and the final one, 34, all of the rest are out of chronological order. They're just put in terms of how they're presented. In the same year, he applied for permission to work in the British Museum. He had a long, ongoing relationship with BM, drawing specimens there, and he produced the first catalogue for the museum in 1778, 4 years after the birth of uterus. And that was his attempt to strike out on his own, to be this natural history artist, this kind of higher level artist that he thought that he could be. The work, Hunter's legacy had been assured, which was a feat impossible without Van Rimstick. His images are unique in their strange allure, for all their gruesome reality. In them, he managed to combine the Enlightenment ideal of beauty and truth. As Hunter said, the magic of Jan van Rimstick is that he represents what was actually seen. It carries the mark of truth and becomes almost as infallible as the object itself. And this is true, isn't it? It was passing across continents to teach people how to save women's lives. So, Jan's working on the Museum Britannicum, and it's going to be his final work. And in it, he demonstrates, sadly, his contempt for Hunter, the man who had used his services so ruthlessly. It is a dishonest, mean cunning in making oneself a great man with other people's merit. Jan, now that Hunter's magnum opus had been finished, was surplus to requirements and jettisoned. The Museum Britannicum is often viewed as secondary to the study of Jan van Rimstick's work, but it reveals more of the man than his medical illustrations. The second edition, published in 1791 after his death by Peter Boyle, contained a foreword stating that the original work had employed the deceased author 45 years in close study. predating Rimsek's interest in natural history to his arrival in London and indeed to his teenage years. And certainly the few writings we have of his would indicate that this was true. So, Jan's greatest wish to paint a portrait that would feature in the Royal Academy was fulfilled very soon after this by his son John, who exhibited two enamel miniature portraits there, the end of Jan's life. When William Hunter died, 1783, he was distinctly unmourned by his long-term employee, though missed by his students. Yet even in death, Van Rimsek could not break the bonds of his former master, and Hunter's intellectual heir, Thomas Denman, who was a student, took over his role and also took on Van Rimsek as an anatomical artist. His last decade was very quiet, and Andrew died soon after the publication of the museum account Britannica. Rimsek worked for Thomas Denman, who, like Smellie, conducted his business chiefly amongst the lower class of people. He was brilliant, Denman, who he brought Hunter's work to the poor people. It's a great combination. In 1787, he published a collection of engravings tending to illustrate the generation of and parturation of animals in the human species, of which we did have an image to show you, but we're not going to disrupt this presentation. And it shows very much the return to the earlier, softer, gentler style of illustration. And interestingly, some of these images were also coloured at the same time, so you get the move on goes again. Unlike his predecessors, Denman fully recognised the contribution of the 18th century's foremost medical artist. Some years ago, without any view to this publication, I began to have drawings taken, whenever they appeared likely to give a more comprehensive view of the science of midwifery. My collection is not large, but they are all taken from nature, and there is so much truth and elegance in the drawings executed by Mr. Rimsek that they may be considered as patterns for all future artists. Finally, fame had come. The following year, the advertisement for the new 1788 edition of Smellie's treatise began, "Dr. Smellie, having with great love and expense employed Mr. Rimsek to draw anatomical figures," which I think shows you where his heart lay in the whole business. Jan died in 1789, his will reflecting his constant draw-alone address. Maria survived him. He possessed a small but significant collection of old master drawings, which he had labelled the Rimsek Museum. Some of these now reside in the British Museum. John fades from view after his father's death, and we do not know what happened to him. But Jan van Rimsek will not fade from view. A portrait painter by inclination, who honed his art drawing the dissected bodies of women and their children. The women are all headless, and though we will never know, although we know some of their identities, we will never see their faces, just as we will never see his. His life was difficult and conflicted, but he knew the truth himself when he said, "I have been a very useful designer and sacrificed my talents to a good purpose, more so than any painter in my profession in this kingdom." Thank you very much.
So much, Lucy. Do we have questions for Lucy?
Paint one up. Yes.
This was a question about in the earlier, are you talking about sort of the Vesalius era?
Yeah.
In the time when the Renaissance, lots of artists were publishing these new, particularly theories of circulation and musculature. And the images were highly plagiarised and circulated. And the gentleman was just saying it doesn't seem that this happened so much in the 18th century. Interestingly, engraving probably reaches its peak of quality during the Renaissance. So people could plagiarise those works which were incredibly rare, and people certainly wanted to see them, and there was a market for them. Also, they were mainly done on the continent, and travel was long and tedious. So people did know there was a market, and so plagiarism was pretty constant throughout that period. These were a really special set of works. You do get them copied, but they're just nowhere near the quality. Particularly this is the most famous image of the baby, where you can see how it's got stuck and everything, and it's incredible. In the original drawing, the red chalk drawing, the baby's quite covered in gore and all that sort of thing. And these images were, there's no one working at this level who could reproduce it. Although you do get some crude ones, but no, I would say overall. Yes, sir.
Understand that the East Century London is a demographic shift where births finally outnumber death. So there's a rising population, some would have an increased consumption of gin. I'm wondering if improvements in obstetrics also contribute to this, if it's in the case of that.
Yes, it's a short answer, yes. Lots of things, a vague understanding of not germs, but sort of cleanliness and things like that also helps towards the end of the 18th century. And it is really towards the end that you do get the shift. But very, very interestingly, gin because very strong fortified spirits have never been available to the poorest classes, brandy was really the only thing, and that was either medicine or for the more wealthy people. When gin was available very cheaply, London between 1740 and 1745 saw an enormous boom in addiction amongst women, and also fetal alcohol syndrome. And it really scares the medical profession in London, and they begin to work. You see the theory of addiction emerging as a disease, which is totally new, because previously it had really just been self-medication. But we're talking about women prostituting themselves and prostrating themselves in the street with cheap liquor. And these theories of addiction, and also the problems of women and their bodies, and when Hunter and Smellie are both working, rises incredibly quickly, and it's find this solution, find the answer to these problems. And so you're quite right, gin does create, it's a terrible scourge, but it galvanises both society and the medical profession into helping women. So it does actually have, probably overall, in terms of scientific terms, a very positive effect. Yeah. Anyone else? I'll take from the gentleman here and then the lady there. So please let us know. Yeah? Well, I don't know, you were across the line, I'm not sure who was first.
How did the artists come by the models? Were these patients of hunters, or is there sort of an underground singing?
Very different.
So the diet of
There aren't many accidents. There's two accidents, I think, aren't there? But mainly, it's to do with this baby being too big. There's definitely one case that appears to be preeclampsia or a stroke. The difficulty with it is that Hunter attended wealthy women who would have presented to him early with a condition. So he would have seen he talks mainly about the month of pregnancy, so from 8 months onwards he would have spotted, he'd been in a position to spot problems. Therefore he can spot a body. However, the women, a body that's a potential subject, however, the women that he's going to be dissecting, their families aren't interested in their bodies being dissected. So he's between a rock and a hard place. Whereas William Smellie, who is really the emergency man, is dealing very often with very poor women whose bodies, either he could talk their families around, that if you let me do this, this will help women in the future. And he was very persuasive. Or there is a question of payment, and I think certainly on all counts, payment would have changed hands. And I think that although it's quite distasteful, the Mackenzie incident probably indicates to me that Hunter and his medical students who were attending workhouses and the early maternity wards in workhouses, which we had from the 1740s, would certainly be keeping an eye out for these women that were in trouble, which is sad, the reality of the situation. So This, does that answer your question? Of how they came across the bodies? Yeah. Yeah? Okay, yes, please. The hunter images are unique, I would say. The smelly images are inspired in that great tradition of continental models and engravers. I was chatting to my husband, who is involved in silver and porcelain, and one of the engravers we'd found out, who engraved some of the hunter plates, was also a modeller for a silversmith and the Chelsea Porcelain Factory, but he modelled mainly women's bodies. So he would have been kind of a natural guy to bring in. But the continental Dutch and German modellers and engravers did have a very distinctive style, which surpasses anyone else, either in 2D or 3D. And when, even now just answering that question. Sorry, and the question was, what was the inspiration for him to produce these images? Is that... perhaps the 3D influence of these amazing sculptors and modellers who...
And also just which of the engravers you think was looking at. I mean, you have specific artists that people may have been,
Not really. I think he that's why I really do feel as strongly about him as I do. I think he's really distinctive. I think that comes out in his character as well. But he did. The person who was thought to interpret his work most sympathetically was Charles Grignion, who was really engraved a lot of precious metal and also things like clocks and watches. So, but they were thought to work very well together. Any other questions, please? Then I'll see if the floor's bandy. Thank you so much, Lucy Ingalls. Thank you.